Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the new film, Killers of the Flower Moon, tells the story of the Osage murders of the 1920s. Who are the Osage? How much does the film describe their history? And what did it miss? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. With the release of the critically acclaimed new film, Killers of the Flower Moon, there's a new interest in the murders of the Osage tribe following the discovery of oil on tribal lands. But how much do we know about the Osage? Their history, their life experiences, the legal challenges that Indigenous peoples had throughout the region? And how typical was this particularly gruesome set of murders on tribes in the U.S., and again, particularly in Oklahoma and that region? On today's show, we'll explore the history of the Osage. We'll get to know their story in greater detail and ask, what did the film get right and what did it miss? Our panel is Robert Warrior. He's the Hall Distinguished Professor of American Literature and Culture at the University of Kansas and a member citizen of the Osage Nation. He's the author of numerous books, including Tribal Secrets, Recovering American Indian Intellectual Traditions. He's the past president of the American Studies Association, was the founding president of the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, the founding co-editor of Native American and Indigenous Studies, and in 2018 was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And Robert Miller, he's professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. He's the interim chief justice at Pascua Yaqui Tribe Court of Appeals. He is an enrolled citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe, and he's the author of numerous pieces, including a very recent publication, a new book, A Promise Kept, The Muskogee Creek Nation and McGirt versus Oklahoma. Thank you both very, very much for joining us. Robert Warrior, I want to start with you. You are our Osage historian. How accurate is the film in its depiction of the Osage? What did it get right and what did it miss?
Well, that's a big question. Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Doug, for having me on. And, you know, the big question of the film, of course, is permeating. It seems like every discussion that I have, lots of Osages have, and that we've been having for the past 3 years, even before that with David Grand's book that the film is based on, you know. So these are issues that a lot of us have been thinking about. But, of course, for many of us, especially those of us who are, we have three villages that we connect ourselves to as Osages. There used to be five, now there's three. And Gray Horse is one of those. And Gray Horse is one of the places portrayed in the film. It's the place where this particular murder plot in the Martin Scorsese picture takes place and where it's set also in Fairfax. Fairfax and Gray Horse are a couple of miles apart. And that's where my Osage family is from. And so those of us who are from Gray Horse have connections there, have a special interest in that part of the story, but the murders in general and that era of spectacular wealth and of fraud and of violence, all of that took place really across our reservation. So all Osages tend to care about these issues and cared about them before David Grand's book. And, you know, we'll continue caring about them when other people turn their attention to other things. And I do think that that era is in so many ways influential upon the ways that so many things in Osage life happen. And I could go on and on and on about that. But to speak particularly to the film, much of the film is a joy to watch because of its historical depiction of the people and the places that you can see in it, that you can't just go see someplace. And so seeing, you know, downtown Fairfax in 1925 recreated so spectacularly. It was done in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, which is the agency town of on a reservation. So they recreate that into Fairfax, which is about 25 miles away. You know, it's really great to see. And then to see so many of the clothes and things that, you know, that have been recreated or have been used, vintage clothes, things like shawls, blankets, all of the little accoutrements, the little touches. So many people, you'll hear Osages talk about how they brought their family things into, you know, the shawls and clothes and things maybe that a grandmother or great-grandmother had. So you see all those things. And of course, you see the people, you know, I mean, many of the people in the film who you see in some of the small roles, like Chief Bonnycastle, played by my friend Yancey Redcorn, who I've known, you know, forever and ever. It's seeing, you know, seeing somebody like that, or his first cousin Tolly Redcorn, who plays what they call the Nononshinka, the old man at the very beginning of the story, who's burying this pipe, conducting the ceremony, who speaks Osage through it. Seeing people like that in the film it's a real odd thing to sit in a theater, especially when you see it like I did back in July, the special screening for people from Gray Horse in Tulsa. So you got a room full of Osages watching a bunch of Osages playing parts and also being extras in this film about Osages. So a lot of that part is really gratifying to see. And of course, it's, you know, one thing I always say when I drive down to our reservation, when it just automatically comes to my mind within the first, you know, minute or two that I'm there, I go, boy, our reservation is such a beautiful place. And, you know, seeing those aerial shots in the film where you see that, you know, all of those are of the Osage Reservation. And it's really just a beautiful place. And I guess many people think of, you know, their hometown or where they're from or their reservation as, you know, being this really beautiful place. You know, there's a lot more to the story. And I guess there are two, if I could just say two really quick ways of thinking about this that I thought a lot about in connection to the film. You know, one is, how full is the portrayal in the film of this era and the things that it covers with the murders and the dispossession of Osages from their wealth? And, you know, there's just so much more to it. And I think that the film, for me, didn't succeed in that way because it misses a lot about a lot of things that Bob Miller knows about federal policy and the bureaucracy that supports it, and that really not ever really getting around to saying that it's really that bureaucracy and policy that actually enable what happens in the film. I mean, I think we're led to believe in the film that it's just the nature of evil and the nature of greed that leads somebody like William Hale to do what he does. Certainly that plays a part, you know, but I think that federal policy enables the things that take place to happen. So, you know, I'd say that, and that's missing from, I think, both the book and from the film, disappointingly. And that's hard to watch because there were so many more things that happened. So many more people died than we see in the film, even when it tries to expand the idea. There are all these uninvestigated murders. It was a lot more extensive. And it doesn't end at the end of the film either. And I guess the other time, I won't say as much about this, but, you know, films are not the only way that we tell our stories. And so, right? And so when we say, how could the film have been better? You know, I think more about it as, how do we as Osage people, how do other people who care about these issues think about this story, and what are the ways we do it? One of the ways we do it is to say that our history is much more complex and bigger than, you know, than 1 5-year period or 1 10-year period, you know, and to say that that's one part of who we are as Gray Horse Osages.
And actually, a point that you raised here, and I'm going to ask both of you, I'm actually going to turn to Bob Miller on this. I answered first, but I think you both have a great deal to say about this, is the book itself is almost as much a celebration of federal action to try to stop the murders. I mean, the narrative is really about the founding of the creation of the FBI. And so many of the heroes are, you know, FBI agents who are tracking this down. And so at one level, the book is a, you know, true crime story about trying to figure out, you know, right, who's doing the killing. The film at least shifts the attention much more so to the Osage. But at the end of the day, and this is so true of so many films and so many narratives, it's the federal government who comes in, whether it's the civil rights movement, the federal government coming in to, you know, protect populations, or in this case, obviously, the federal government coming in to protect indigenous peoples. And Bob Miller, that's not actually the history of the federal government's role vis-a-vis whether it's the Osage or so many of the different tribes, is it?
No, absolutely not. I use more and more often in every talk I give a letter that General George Washington sent to the Articles of Confederation Congress in September of 1783, in which he advised the Congress about how American Manifest Destiny was going to proceed and the growth of the Western settlements of the U.S. and how Indian peoples were just destined to get out of the way. This is called the Savage's Wolf Letter because he analogized Indians to animals. And then he used this line, and this is a quote. But first off, he says, the savage as the wolf. I think there's a dash. And then this is the quote. Both being beasts of prey, though they differ in shape. period, close quote. George Washington was telling us what federal policy would be towards Native peoples. It's interesting that you mentioned, yes, I first saw this story when I was young because there was that 1965 movie with Jimmy Stewart in it called The FBI Story. And these Osage murders and how the FBI got a lot of good publicity is one of the chapters in the development of the FBI. But this is absolutely illegal theft, organized governmental theft and genocide by the state of Oklahoma. And as you said, Doug, by the federal government doing absolutely nothing to stop it. In the movie, they showed something I didn't remember, but the Osage were going to D.C., demanding protection, demanding help. That I didn't remember myself. And just for your audience, I'm no Osage history expert. I'm here to talk in general on federal policy issues.
And Robert, I guess part of it is, I mean, clearly some of the acts, the murders themselves are illegal, but the seizing of headwaters through marriage and some of the other acts done by white people to Osage, you know, tribal members, stuff is completely legal, right?
Well, I mean, it's not just legal. I mean, this is what the allotment policy was supposed to do. Right. This is, in fact, the allotment policy in the 1880s is designed to, first of all, to, you know, subdivide Native lands to create surpluses of those lands so that those surpluses can be auctioned off, can be given away by the federal government, you know, to universities, for instance, right, to land grant universities. And what happens with the Osage mineral estate is that the Osages negotiate to have it be held by the group, but it's not held communally. It's actually held by individual shareholders so that the, you know, the U.S. government creates the same sort of system that it does for land in the 1906 Osage Allotment Act, is that you take the mineral estate and you divide it up one share for everybody who's on the tribal roll at that point, 2,229 people. And then the only way for somebody born after that to participate in the mineral estate is by inheriting part of one of those headright shares. And so having a headright then is not limited at that point, in the same way that somebody could sell their land after a certain amount of time, right, in the allotment scheme to a non-Native person. A headright could be inherited by a non-Native person as well. And it's not until later, it's not until what happens in the 1920s that this becomes recognized as a problem. And, you know, and I think that one of the things, just follow up on what Bob said, you know, it's not just the inaction of the federal government, but that's a sort of an active inaction, right? I mean, it's purposeful. I think that one of the things when you establish a policy and somebody is telling you how it's not working, but it's still the policy, it's very hard for a government to step in and say, well, we're now going to stop doing this thing because the policy hasn't changed, right? And the policy is, in fact, to move things in this direction where the Osages are no longer in control of their own resources, where in fact, the resources of Native people become available to everyone, right? And so I think that that's a big part of what's going on. And I think one of the things that's really missing from the story, that not only lets the federal government off the hook for the murders and gives them credit for, you know, ending this particular, you know, murder scheme, but it also removes, I think, part of the wily wisdom and intelligence of Osage leaders at the time. They knew that these were the problems. You know, so in the film, you get the portrayal of the chief saying, hey, you know, if we could just find out who these people are, we would go get them, right? But I mean, I think all those chiefs at that point, they knew that it wasn't necessarily the people who are actually swindling them or murdering them who are the problem, but it's the people who are pulling the strings elsewhere. How do you change these policies? How do you change that relationship to the federal government, which is, you know, next to impossible at that point.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker, and we're talking about the history of the Osage people and the relationship between the government, the state of Oklahoma, the federal government, and the tribes in the region, with Robert Warrior of the University of Kansas and Robert Miller of Arizona State University. And so, Robert Warrior, I want to follow this up a bit, because the way that you've described this whole headwater, the idea that all the land was divided. Head rights. That every individual owned a part of this. That's an imposition of American property norms on the Osage, correct? Absolutely. So part of it was that's not how the Osage would have viewed any resources on tribal lands until it was imposed upon them. I guess my question then would be how much this was a means by which to try to seize these rights, and B, at some level, disempowered the Osage by compelling them on sovereign territory, by the way, property rights that were not consistent with their own norms, with their own history.
Right. I think that's an enormous part of the story. And it's a very specific imposition, too, that I think does go back to Jefferson. And you can trace it all the way through federal policy and seeing how the goal becomes creating individuals who are no longer related to each other, and such that one of the things that Merrill Gates says, who's one of the friends of the Indians from the allotment era from the 1880s, and then Teddy Roosevelt adopts this phrase, allotment is the pulverizing engine, of federal Indian policy. It's the pulverizing engine that breaks apart the bonds of people within Native communities. That's the whole goal of it. And I think that when you adopt a system like the headright system now, even though you have Osages sharing the wealth amongst shareholders, you're doing so one by one, 2,229 shares, and then how that's split up amongst people. This means that there's no possibility of saying, how do we as a group want to use this wealth, right? Which is typically what now people see this happening with casinos, other enterprises that Native groups have. Oftentimes that resource, the revenue, is held by the tribal government. And then they decide, how do we want to use this, right? You don't just say, and people found out that these sort of per capita payments, which the headright system is a sort of a form of that, where it just gets doled out to individuals. Now, this just lets individuals go say, this is what I want to do with my money. Well, that's a very American thing to do, right? I mean, that's mine. I want to figure out what I want to do with it. But to not have the opportunity to say, we have all this wealth, what do we do with it, right? And I think that that's a huge, enormous change. And that doesn't just relate to a traditional way of Osages thinking about property, but about how do Osages in their situation in the 1890s, in the 1906, in 1925, want to think about their own resources and how to use them as a group. That's not allowed, and it's imposed by somebody else.
And Bob Miller, that's not unique to the Osage, is it?
No, and I'd like to mention something I just taught in class a few hours ago, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. To get the tribal land claims out of the way of that oil pipeline that America wanted, Congress created a system in which tribes were turned into corporations, mm-hmm. and that the individual tribal citizens were made shareholders of that corporation and held 100 shares each. It sounds exactly like these Osage headrights. And as Professor Warrior said, this comes from the allotment era to break up the global, the communally owned tribal landmass, put it in the individual ownership of Indians, because then it can more easily be gotten away from them and sold to the average American. And again, I say this runs directly from what George Washington said in 1783. He said it would be cheaper to do it through treaties than warfare, but the United States is going to get it sooner or later. So this Alaska situation, a lot of people compare the ANCSA Act to allotment itself. And so now with what Professor Warrior is saying, yes, this is like very similar to the Osage headrights.
I agree completely. Yeah, it is very, very similar. The shareholding, the corporatizing, and I think we see a model for that come out of the Osage Allotment Act in 1906.
Yeah, and Robert, being a lover of and citing history, I don't know that we have to ask this question, but I need to, about what these historical experiences mean for contemporary relations between the tribes and the state, the tribes and the federal government. I guess one of the lessons that seemingly, drawing from this, is since this is still taking place, how much does this historical experience of depriving the Osage of rights, and, you know, taking the rights, the theft of the oil, just mirror so much about what's going on in contemporary politics and the relationship between the tribes, you know, the tribes and the government? The Osage are still battling these sorts of issues, correct?
Oh, correct. You know, and you know, many headright shares are still held by non-Osages. Some of them are held even by institutions, educational institutions, churches, other institutions that were, you know, that received them as bequests at some point. And so being able to even use some form of moral sway, and it's one of the things that our chief, Jeff Standing Bear, has done in the aftermath of the film, is to say, whatever else you thought of the film, we're still here, and, you know, we still don't have control over our own resources. And some of these are, in fact, institutions that you would hope have some sort of moral compass that would say, why are we holding on to this particular resource? You know, where did we get it? How did it come to us? I mean, these things really do come down to trust, the trust doctrine, the idea of the federal government playing the role of trustee in Native affairs. And that is, I think, where you have to go to see the continuing issues that remain to be addressed. And this is true across, you know, the Native world, really, in the U.S. and other places as well.
And Bob Miller, the history of the government taking lands that have been promised to tribes and sovereign lands. First of all, I have to note your most recent book, A Promise Kept. I think the point of that is that's actually fairly rare, right? They actually keep those promises. And the level of surprise that you were that here's a rare case of a promise kept. Are we moving in a direction where at least the visibility of the history of these policies is creating any sort of opposition to just continually seizing resources and land from the tribes? Or is this still pretty much American policy?
Well, as long as Justice Gorsuch stays on the court and he gets four supporters, we appear to be doing quite well in the recent Supreme Court. What you mentioned about the law, of course, is that when Oklahoma was admitted to the Union, the 1906 Enabling Act, Congress ordered that it disclaim any jurisdiction over tribal peoples and tribal lands. And Oklahoma put that in its very first constitution, Article 1. Of its 1907 constitution, we disclaim any claim to tribal lands, et cetera. The argument that there were no tribes in existence in Oklahoma in 1907 is ludicrous. Congress itself, in the 1906 Enabling Act, named about 19 different tribal groups, sometimes a time or two using the word reservation, and other time using lands, referring to my tribe, which is in the very northeast corner of Oklahoma, as being those other tribes northeast of Cherokee. That's how the act referred to us. So the Eastern Shawnee and the other eight tribes, at least we got a passing reference in the act. But my point is that Congress knew there was Indian country. Oklahoma agreed as a condition of being created as a state that it would not exercise jurisdiction over these nations and Indian people's property. And it immediately violated those rules. The Osage murders is a horrific and egregious situation. But from day one, Oklahoma's goal was to steal, legally or illegally, every valuable asset and every piece of land that tribal nations owned. In the first article I wrote on my McGirt case, I cited all the reports that were sent to Congress. And so Robert Warriors are sort of mentioning that the feds actively ignored what the facts were. And I'm just looking just one footnote, but there were reports to Congress in 1904, 1912, 1914, 1923, 1924, 1925, 1926 about how the Oklahoma probate courts were illegally stealing assets and land from individual Indians. Indians would be named incompetent by an attorney appointed by the probate judge, wink, wink, with bribes that everyone knew. Justice Gorsuch mentions this, you know, being more sedate maybe than I am. He says this pretty gently, but here, let me read you what he says in the McGirt opinion. For a time, Oklahoma courts appear to have entertained sham competency and guardianship proceedings that divested tribal members of oil-rich allotments. Whatever else might be said about the history and demographics placed before us, they hardly tell a story of unalloyed respect for tribal interest. So Gorsuch recognized what the history really shows and what Congress completely ignored. Because don't forget, they were all carrying out George Washington's 1783 advice. We're going to get all the lands and all the timber, mineral, oil, any resources tribal peoples own, because it's better off if Americans own it. That was the attitude, and that's what Oklahoma did for 100 years until the McGirt decision pulled them up short.
So the consistency of these policies really rather striking, the shocking nature of the murders notwithstanding, you know, making that, you know, potentially even more shocking and maybe a bit more written about it, but it was consistent generally with the policy, it sounds like. Now, Robert Warrior, you mentioned something that I certainly want to highlight here, that part of what the film, part of what the book, part of what the interest in all this is a reminder that the Osage are still here. I have to admit, I, you know, went to see the film with a group and somebody asked me, wait, are the Osage still around? And I said, absolutely, they are. So I guess the question, because I know you focus a great deal on artistic, on literature expressions as well. How much should our focus be? We need to remember this history because these are still nations. These are still peoples who live, you know, who live here, and how maddening it is that there's just even people today not realizing these tribes exist. They're still here. They're still contributing such a tremendous amount of art, of history, literature, et cetera. And that this film is a means by which to remind us that we're still here.
Right. I think that that's always, I mean, I think that's one of the, I guess it's a struggle that doesn't end, really, is being able to announce your existence to people over and over again, and that you're continuing, your persistence as peoples is a fact, and it doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. You know, even really, really tiny small groups, medium-sized groups like the Osages, really large groups, even when they're not thriving, they're around, and they're really seeking ways to do to make their way into the future. I just spent the weekend at Yale and got to see a young man, one of our Osage people, who's also Oto Missouria and Eastern Band Cherokee, who's graduating this year, Truman Pipestem. And, you know, I said, when I had a chance to say so publicly, you know, his great-great-grandfather and my great-great-grandfather were leaders of a band together, you know, so long ago. And I graduated from... I got a master's degree at Yale back in the 1980s. And, you know, I said, at one level, I always think, wow, what if you had told them in 1906, 1910, you will have great-great-grandsons, both of whom will have degrees from, you know, one of the finest colleges in the world. And I always think like, well, yeah, they'd go, really? They'd be surprised. But at another level, knowing what I know about them now that I'm older, I think like they would have said, that sounds about right. Because I think that they knew already in their minds, they were thinking 24 hours a day, how do we work ourselves out of this situation? You mentioned to me that Jean Dennison wasn't able to be on the show today, which is unfortunate. She's a wonderful Osage scholar. And I'm going to borrow one of her ideas, which is colonial entanglement, that really what's created through Native history, through law, through policy, through the sorts of ideologies that make us seem like we don't exist anymore, through the sort of myth of vanishing, these are all tangled up together. And so much of the role of anyone trying to move into the future is to do their part in the untangling of that big mess. And if you've ever untangled a really big mess, you know what that's like, right? And that this is how this particular story of colonialism has worked for the Osage, for the Eastern Shawnees, for other people as well. Untangling it and realizing that work of untangling is immense. You know, I think when I think about what people in Native law are doing now, you realize that not just them, but previous generations of people have been at this strategizing. You know, what do we do now? Because we have, let's say, an opening at the Supreme Court. What do we do now? And we just sort of need to hide out. The last thing you want to do is bring a Supreme Court case right now. So let's do all these other things. What can you do sort of in hiding? What can you do that people won't notice? You know, do you need to challenge the law and say this should have never been decided this way? Or do you need to see the ways that you can work within it and say, hey, you told us we could work within this law. And guess what? We found out how to do it. And now you're mad at us for looking, you know, figuring out a way to work within it. But all of that for people who are leaders, whether they're elected leaders or local leaders, leaders in their families, et cetera, I think is always just saying, How do we move forward? How do we do our part of that untangling this mess and figure out how we can persist?
And Bob Miller, one of the ways this question about entanglement keeps coming up in the courts is the way in which we view Indigenous peoples, the way in which we view the tribes, the desire on the part of non-members of the tribes, whites in particular, wanting to view it as a racial issue versus this is a sovereignty issue. These are actual nations. I know there have been some recent decisions that have been siding with the recognition that the tribes are, in fact, you know, sovereign entities and should be treated as sovereign entities. A, what does that mean? And B, does it look like this is going to continue?
Federal Indian law has always recognized the tribe. Well, I said federal Indian. Federal law has always recognized tribes as governments and their citizens as political entities of their own nation. This is in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the U.S. Constitution, what's called the Interstate Commerce Clause that we, the Supreme Court and all of us, call the Indian Commerce Clause also. Our founding fathers understood that they had to deal with tribes as governments. How'd they do that? They signed treaties. You don't sign treaties with racial groups as an affirmative action type thing. The Supreme Court has decided three times in the 1970s that Indian law is based on political status. Tribal citizenship is not a racial determination. It is a political determination, as any government decides its own citizenship. And the recent case you referred to was about the Indian Child Welfare Act that the Supreme Court just ruled in the Brackeen case, very favorable for Indian sovereignty and for Congress's power over Indian affairs to enact the Indian Child Welfare Act. And the state and the individuals, non-Indians in that case, were arguing that defining an Indian child by recognition of their own tribe was racial determination. The Supreme Court struck that down so quickly, you hardly even notice the reference. But I don't think we have any problem with the Supremes and Congress continuing to recognize that tribes are governments. And, you know, Robert and I are citizens of our own tribal government. So we're U.S. citizens, we're state citizens, but we're also tribal citizens. And with that, like always, come some benefits and some obligations of citizenship.
Robert Warrior, I'm going to give you the last word. Are there a couple of authors that in particular, if people would like to learn about, you know, Osage traditions, Osage history, Osage identities, that you would recommend?
I would say for scholars who want to know more about the Osages right now, Jean Dennison is a great place to start. Her book, Colonial Entanglements, is wonderful. There's an author, a really good friend of mine who passed away about 8 years ago. Charles Redcorn wrote a novel called A Pipe for February, available with University of Oklahoma Press. And it's coming out, I think, with a new foreword by Martin Scorsese. And if you in the film, the very first words you hear are actually Charles's words. And that's definitely a book worth reading. My students have always loved it. It's about that era of the murders as well. I'd also look up Ryan Redcorn, who's one of our, you know, really great media people out in the Osage world. And there's tons more people like that. And I would take a look at some of those.
Thank you very much. And I'd also like to include that books like Tribal Secrets, Recovering American Indian Intellectual Traditions, written by our guest Robert Warrior, the Hall Distinguished Professor of American Literature and Culture at the University of Kansas. He is a member and citizen of the Osage Nation, past president of the American Studies Association, founding president of the Native American Indigenous Studies Program, and in 2018 elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And Robert Miller, great book. If you haven't picked up yet, we actually had a show specifically on this book when it came out, A Promise Kept, Muskegee Creek Nation and McGirt versus Oklahoma. Robert Miller's professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University and is the interim chief justice at Pascua Yaqui Tribe Court of Appeals and an enrolled citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. Thank you both very, very much for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
When we come back, we explore the unique gender relationships within the Osage. Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Women are central to the story of the Osage that is featured in the film Killers of the Flower Moon. What exactly were the gender relationships within the Osage Nation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In addition to highlighting the violence against the Osage, the film Killers of the Flower Moon focuses on the distinctly gendered relationships between the Osage and their white spouses. The film itself focuses on Osage women, and most notably Lily Gladstone's Molly and their white husbands, the type of risk that they faced as a result of those husbands. And one of the most amazing aspects of the film, of the acting of the film, is the way Lily Gladstone is able to portray both her love for and abject fear of her husband. So this asks the question, what were the gender dynamics and what are the gender dynamics of the Osage people? And then also we will address how much the violence against the Osage and against Indigenous peoples, you know, broadly should be focused just on Oklahoma or also some of the other states, specifically of Kansas. So our guest in this segment is Ty Edwards. She's Associate Professor of History and the Director of the Kansas Studies Institute at Johnson County Community College. And she's the author of Osage Women and Empire, Gender and Power. Ty Edwards, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Gender plays such a significant role in the story of the Osage murders. What exactly were the gender dynamics during this period among the Osage?
First, I should say I'm non-native, so I'm an academic who's studying this in an academic context, so I'm not Osage. But I should also say the way I've examined this is primarily in the 18th and 19th century, and we'll talk a little, the 20th century is, of course, when this reign of terror takes place. But in terms of the Osage, and this is common for a lot of Indigenous nations across North America, is they had a system we call gender complementarity. And so what that means is you have different gender roles based on gender identity. And I should say the Osage, like many Indigenous North Americans, had a spectrum of gender identities, right? So male and female are the polarized, but there are gendered identities between those. And so those gendered roles, especially for men and women, were defined very specifically in terms of what kind of work people would do. And the reason why we use the word complementarity is though those are different jobs and different roles by gender, they are equally valued in the society. So, you know, we think of gender equality, right, as the term that my students are usually accustomed to, but gender equality usually implies that any kind of work is available regardless of gender. Complementarity implies there is gendered work, but it's equally valued. So in the Osage, the way we describe it and the way I describe it in my work is Osage women were viewed as people who had creative power, much like Wakanda or other creative power in the universe, because they created human life. And so because they create human life, they did similar kinds of creative work. So agriculture was women's work in the Osage society, and this is common in a lot of Indigenous North American societies. So planting and cultivating crops was viewed as the same kind of work as growing humans. And so they did creative work related to that. Also, of course, they prepare meals, they process hides. And in the Osage society, one thing I think that's important to note is in military battle, right, we often think of like hunting and military as men, right, and life-giving is women. But from the Osage perspective, men and women's courage was combined in battle, and they were both credited in victories because women would spiritually combine through ritual and ceremony with men who were off at war. And also our stereotype is often that hunting is men, right, and agriculture is women. But again, from the Osage perspective, men did the killing in hunting, but women did all of the processing of the hides, right? The creative aspect of the labor. And so those are things that made their society gender complementarity. And I will say the one thing I do in my work, if you know much about Osage history, in the 18th and early 19th century, they were considered as a nation that had a significant amount of power. Some people say an empire on the South Central Plains because they were so dominant in that region. And a lot of the scholars have long hinted that that power supposedly came from men's power going above women's power. But in fact, and my book argues that Osage men and women viewed themselves as complementarity, and they believed that both genders were needed to succeed. And so when they have success in the late 1700s and early 1800s, they view that as the product of both men and women's labor. And so they built that success together. They built that prosperity together. Yeah,
go ahead,
go ahead. Yeah, well, so when you think about like violence, right? Like when we get to talking about that, that's not something that's only going to be experienced by women, at least in the traditional context, right? That violence is going to be on everyone.
Were the Osage unique in this gender complementarity, or is this something that's fairly consistent with the tribes in the plains, the tribes in the region?
Yeah, so this is very common in many Indigenous North American societies, not all, but I will say the Osage are one of five relative nations that lived sort of in what we call the prairie plains, maybe not entirely just plains living. So the Omaha, the Quapaw, the Kaw or the Kanza, and the Osage and the Ponca. And those are all five nations. They speak dialects of the same language. And you see that in those nations very similarly in the way they're constructed. But you see it in other nations, too, who don't speak varieties of the same language and who are not relatives. Again, it's not every Indigenous North American nation, but it is very common amongst Indigenous societies.
Now, when you're talking about complementarity, is that more of a mindset about the, not the equality, but at least the unique roles that each of the genders are playing? But then it sounds like it might not be all that dissimilar to the perception of gendered roles, gendered constructions in the actual work that was being done. But the perception of the work was different. Is that fair
right.
to say?
I think that's absolutely right. So like when Europeans come and visit Osage communities, let's imagine around 1800, they are just describing it as drudgery, right? Like women are the slaves of men, right? Look at this labor that they're doing. It's absurd that women are farming. Men should be doing that labor, right? Like that's the value judgments that Europeans and Euro-Americans bring to this. But what they didn't see is, for one, in this period, a lot of Osage men's labor and many Indigenous men's labor happened out of town, right? Like if you're just visiting an Osage town, you're not seeing the extremely laborious, dangerous work that men do in hunting and warfare, and also in diplomacy in some ways. But for Osage women, their work happens in town, right? It's easy to see when you go visit. And I think the thing that a lot of people don't recognize is that work wasn't just valued, it was powerful. It was economically owned, right? Osage women owned the fields where they farmed. You know, they owned the produce of that field. You know, it's not just it's valued, it's economically valued in a similar way, but it's also spiritually valued in a similar way, right? So these work roles derive from their understanding of the spiritual world in which they lived. And so you're not just doing this work because it's, you know, convenient or that's what the other ladies living nearby do. It's because it's believed that it's spiritually defined that this is the way that we should behave. And this is what will lead us to be successful in our communities and in our world.
You used a verb there I want to explore, and it's that these were owned, because that certainly came up in the previous segment about the way in which the head rights were all individually assigned, an ownership model that fit, you know, the American model, a European model, rather than any sort of community model. So I guess the question is, you know, when you say it's owned, is this still something where the perception is that the fields and the products of the fields have at least some degree of communal ownership, or at least communal consideration? Or was there a fairly distinct conception of ownership?
Yeah, well, I think we should maybe be distinguishing between this is the land that our nation holds as ours, right? As that we defend from invasion, that we protect, and that we have spiritual and other responsibilities toward all the organisms that live in it. I think there's that. But then I think there's layers inside of that. So where women did their agricultural labor, that labor produced, you know, material goods that those women had ownership over. So I wouldn't say that like individual field ownership is at the exclusion of the nation. It is in concert with the nation. And you see, you know, women directing their male spouses to, or their male relatives to do the farming in that area, which men could do farming labor, but they had to do it under the direction of a woman because she knows what she's doing and she owns that plot or she owns that field. And so I think you can have multiple conceptions of ownership that happen simultaneously. And you are hinting at this other sort of myth that Indigenous people didn't have a sense of land ownership. They didn't have a sense of individual private property, which is a very sort of Western European construction. But they absolutely had a conception of land that they dominated and land that they controlled, they had to protect from invasion. And they do this, right? And a lot of people, especially with the Osage, were very powerful, you know, in the 19th century, the 18th century. If you accidentally, you know, wandered onto Osage-controlled territory, you knew that was a risky proposition, right? Like that is not something people did accidentally in amongst their indigenous neighbors and even amongst like French colonizers, right? Like you knew who controlled that and you respected that. And so I think what you're talking about is, I think you're referencing that for the Osage, maybe the transition to a private property system that involves, you know, mineral head rights, like you're saying, or even mineral ownership, right, underneath the sort of main visible ground, is something that I think that Osage people could understand. And I think we're intentionally embracing of, especially if you ask a lot of Osage scholars, right, like the Osage are a nation that you see time and time again, embracing change in ways that make sense in their cultural norms that allow them to be successful. And, you know, that reservation that the Osage pick out, I mean, underneath the constraints of U.S. colonialism, is because they knew that in some ways they would be protected from the assimilationist goals of the federal government on that specific piece because it's not very farmable. And they were aware of resources like salt and other things that had value both to themselves, but also to the people they live among. And that was strategically done and strategically successful. So I do think even in allotment, right, when the federal government forces the Osage to divide their reservation up into individually owned pieces, men and women get equal land ownership, right? And in some indigenous nations, that doesn't happen, not because they didn't want it, but because they can't get the federal government to accommodate it. And, you know, the fact that the Osage accomplished that, I think, leads then to the thing you're talking about, right? There's sort of this ownership of land and fields, right? Allotment ownership, and then mineral headright ownerships. Those things happen in an order that I think allows those things to be possible.
The narrative about the Osage murders, and in particular, the specific story that that David Grund writes about and that Martin Scorsese's film addresses, this scheme for white men to marry Osage women in order to inherit the headrights. And then, of course, the murders within the marriages. It is portraying a fairly, for at least in the West, a fairly traditional notion of intimate partner violence, intimate partner threats, murders, and that women being uniquely vulnerable to violence. Is that a pretty accurate portrayal of the questions within a family structure, within intimate structures within the Osage, either prior to and then, of course, leading up to these crimes?
Well, prior to colonization, domestic violence is basically unknown amongst the Osage, which shouldn't surprise us again because of gender complementarity. In my research, I talk about in my book, divorce was socially acceptable and there was a process. And again, like people just stopped cohabitating and all of your own possessions are still yours. If you're living in the house owned by women and her female relatives or her family members, it's still her house. There's processes for these things. There's no, we sort of think of maybe stigma about divorce. None of that exists. That's culturally not even understood. So these ideas that women had independence and control over themselves in marriage was absolutely the norm in Osage history. Of course, in my work, I go on to talk about Osage women had complete control over their sexuality and their fertility. These are also norms. This idea, and maybe marriage isn't even the right word, for Americans, the word marriage has very specific baggage that comes with it. But sexual exclusivity or virginity, like these are just conceptions that are tied to American understanding of marriage that do not have the same cultural norms in Osage society, even though at the same time, many people had loving monogamous relationships, but it's, based on choice. And so, those kinds of things, I think the paradigm that Osage women had in their own society related to marriage is not very equivalent to what you're seeing in the story, right, Killers of the Flower Moon, in terms of American constructions. But, by the time we get to 1920, and even in the 1800s, many Osage women had intermarried with non-Native men, whether they be French traders or they be, Americans in various ways, right? Like those relationships are not unheard of. But for a lot of those individuals who lived or married Osage women in Osage communities, the Osage norms are dominant, right? Like those women, and they did, right, could divorce or separate from those Euro-American men with no, just because that was their choice and they did it for whatever reasons were important to them. Loving marriage is also well-known. And I think the thing that comes up a lot in my work and then the research I've done is the extreme love of children, right? The very visible love, you know, of family members towards children. And so I think that's, the family unit was in many ways constructed around that. But when I think about the story in the 20th century, what you're talking about with Killers of the Flower Moon, and I don't know if this goes a little away from the question you're asking, but it almost seems to me like our attraction to that story, both in the book and in the film, relates a lot to, we are comfortable or at least familiar with like true crime stories of intimate partner violence and greed. And I think that's what that story really latches onto. And even in the 1920s, Americans were familiar with marrying for money, killing for money, right? Those are not new stories. And so I think that that is sort of part of that even seductiveness of that story to us today. But to me, I think that almost blinds us to the structures that are around that, because if you're thinking about greed and intimate partner violence, it's very easy for a viewer or a reader to think that that is the individual bad choices of that one little group of people, right? It's easy to separate yourself from that, what I would say, colonial violence, right? And the reason why I find that a little troubling is because the violence that sets up this whole scenario that allows this fraud to take place and these murders to take place is so embedded in American life at the time and in for decades in advance. You know, one of the things I talk about in my book is when the Osage are confined to their reservation in Kansas, you know, it's unfarmable. This is terrible for women and their power. They have their horses stolen by settlers, you know, five a day on average for over a decade. That prevents men from protecting their property and their nation. Burials are raided, right? Women were in control of burials in Kansas. So that's attacking not only the living and the dead, but women's work. You know, like every aspect of life and every aspect of gendered work is assaulted when they're in Kansas and invaded by settlers. And my research shows that 70% of the Osage population dies in Kansas. I mean, that's genocide. That is 100% genocide. And there are murders too. I mean, many murders. This is how invaders took property, right? There are people that are saying in Kansas, non-Native people who are saying, there are no rights of Indian men that I have to respect. And the law is bearing that out. You know, they create militias that are supported by the local governor to harass, intimidate, and terrorize Osage people to get access to their land. You know, to me, that's not much different than the story you see in The Killers of the Flower Moon. We're just telling it in a more intimate way. But those kinds of violence are happening in Kansas. You know, people literally dismantling an Osage home when they're not there so they can take those. These beautiful homes that Osage women built and owned, they can steal that so that they can build it for their own house. Literally moving into that house so that an Osage woman can't move back into it when she comes home. Stealing her crops right out of the field. Letting your livestock graze in her field so that she can't have access to that food. Well, that's going to lead to starvation, you know, and that's what it does, right? Starvation then leads to disease. These are all the things that the Osage endure in Kansas. And in some ways, when I think about the reign of terror that happens with the oil, it is absolutely heinous. It is absolutely awful, right? It is, like you said, it's greedy, it's violent, it's intimate partner violence, it's abuse, it's terrorizing. But in some ways, like the scale of what the Osage had to endure in Kansas is even orders of magnitude worse. And when I think about that, I think about how did that destruction set up a scenario where someone like Molly can be vulnerable and her family can be vulnerable to these other forms of predatory violence. And to me, I see it on a continuum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the U.S. government that sets up the ability for that to happen. You know, Congress passes legislation that says we're going to remove every indigenous nation in Kansas. And so, of course, settlers invade before Kansas is even created as a territory, right? Settlers invade Osage and other indigenous land in Kansas. And that's going to lead to violence, right? And the way we talk about it in my discipline in history is this is what settler colonialism does, right? Mm-hmm. Settler colonialism destroys to replace. And so violence in all of its manifestations is going to be part of that. So when we think about Killers of the Flower Moon, intimate partner violence is going to be part of that. But also the other kinds of violence I was talking about in Kansas, right. You know, boarding school violence that assaults right. culture and families. That's also part of this. And so, you know, to me, I think about not just that there's this continuum of violence and colonialism, but I'm a little bit troubled that we as Americans, even today, are still seduced by this true crime style story without seeing this as another culmination of settler colonial violence perpetrated by federal government, state governments, you know, counties, and individuals in communities that surrounded people like the Osage.
The final point is that when we view these stories as individual moments of violence, the crimes themselves, obviously the David Grand book is as much about the creation of the FBI as it is about the systemic violence against the Osage, against indigenous peoples. But hopefully the book, this film, and our conversations will enlarge the conversation about settler violence, about the history of the U.S. federal government, state governments, local governments, the tribes, and of course, what makes this so important, the impact it has on contemporary issues, contemporary legal, political, contemporary social issues between the federal government, the states, and the tribes themselves. So,
yeah, I would also like to say that missing and murdered Indigenous women today remains a stain on our nation that we cannot address this. And this is, again, part of that continuum of violence. The fact that Indigenous women continue to experience disproportionate levels of violence is because of the legacies of these colonial structures in our society today. And when you kill or harm Indigenous women, you are undermining the future of that nation because they are the ones that bear the children in those nations. Yes. And that's not an accident.
Yes, that's a great point upon which to end. And the most important thing of all of this is increasing the visibility of peoples that we have forgotten. Our guest today has been Ty Edwards. She's Associate Professor of History and the Director of the Kansas Studies Institute at Johnson County Community College, and the author of numerous works, including Osage Women and Empire, Gender and Power. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.